to Psalm chapter 11. I want to start with a story from my own personal experience, and I expect that you will have your own stories from your own personal experience that you could add to this. But let me open in prayer. Father, I pray that as we meditate on your word here and confront the demon of the temptation to bolt and not believe in you, the temptation not to trust, I pray that you would fortify our souls to trust in you. I pray this in Jesus' name. Amen. About 18 years ago, my wife and I faced a very difficult situation for us. We were living in the Denver, Colorado area, and I was working for a mission agency out there, and we were far away from family and from the churches that we had grown up in, and we ran out of money. Couldn't pay rent. So we did the only thing we could do, and that was move all our stuff out of our apartment, put a bunch of it in a friend's garage, and put the rest of it in our ancient Toyota minivan, and became homeless. We started out, somebody had a couple days left on a residence hotel, so he stayed there for that weekend, and then the next couple weeks, another friend said, "Well, you can stay in our second bedroom." So we were there, and it began a long process, months for us, of going from house to house and just wondering, "What on earth, God, are you doing?" I struggled with a lot of difficult worries and fears. We could see these different people in our church that were letting us stay in their homes. You know, God was blessing them. They had nice houses and nice jobs and plenty of money. And why wasn't God blessing me? I wasn't making enough money to provide for myself. Did it mean God didn't love me? Was it mean I was doing something wrong? Had God forgotten us? You know, we had left everything to follow him, and now is God just leaving us stranded? We worried about, you know, people in our church and other people in the community looking at us as, you know, those. We had four kids at the time, and, you know, so we were that large family that is mooching off of everybody else in order to make their ends meet. And we felt like people looked down on us for that. Why were we having so many kids? And other people were telling me that I should get out of the ministry. This God wasn't blessing what I was doing. That was a serious consideration for me. If God wasn't blessing that, maybe I should get gainfully employed. Stress was mounting as, you know, month dragged on to month. We moved, kept moving from one house to another, and just agonizing in prayer over this. God, what are you doing? What are you wanting us to do? We're being threatened by, unemployment, poverty, homelessness. I couldn't think of any alternatives. My bachelor's degree in physics and missions didn't really qualify me for anything in particular. All my work experience was in youth ministry, but of course youth pastors don't get paid what a large family needs to live in youth pastors are usually single or very young guys, you know, not guys with four children. I just didn't know what to do. I really believed God had called us to work at this mission agency in Colorado. It felt like we were at the end of the road, and God had given us no way out. And there were times that felt maybe it would be just better to die, and you know, maybe this is it. In hindsight now, I can see, you know, 18 years later, that God was providing a test for us. It was an opportunity for us to trust God at a level we had never had to trust Him before, and for God to pour out blessings on us at a new level than we had experienced before. Looking back on that time, you know, we can see that God used this to make us financially independent. We were deeply in debt from having gone to a Christian college. And since we weren't paying rent, but what little we made, we put on our debts, and we got eradicated them while we were living in other people's homes. While we lived in other people's homes, we built relationships with people far deeper than could normally be done. When you're sharing a house with somebody, you get to know them. And relationships got built deeply that have endured, you know, through the decades. God even used it to redirect me vocationally. I did not want to go to seminary. I was not going to go to seminary. But God kind of forced me into going, and God's providence, you know, it was a wonderful provision for me. This particular seminary offered me a full scholarship, so I was able to graduate from seminary with no debt, which is very unusual. I was able to, and this particular seminary was one that was one of the best in the nation at studying biblical languages, which, if you haven't noticed, you really resonated with me, and I love it. And it prepared me. That was the next step that prepared me for what I'm doing now in pastoring. I can see now that God was in control all along, that God was doing me good, not harm. But when I was in the middle of it, I couldn't see how all that was going to turn out. All I could do was desperately hope that God would deliver me from the threats that loomed so large in my mind. As we look at Psalm 11, the exact circumstances and threats that David faced when he wrote this psalm, we don't know exactly what they are. They're kind of lost in the mists of history. But the truth that David articulates about God's watchful care over his people, they apply to all of us. These truths apply to all of us in any situation where we feel threatened. So let's step into this passage here. Verse 1, it's a psalm of David for the same concert master, or at least for some of the same concert masters that he has written some of the previous psalms for. He says, "In Yahweh I have taken refuge." That's the opening statement that controls the whole psalm here. "In Yahweh I've taken refuge. How is it that y'all say to my soul, flutter away to y'all's hill like a game bird?" This opening statement, "I have taken refuge in the Lord," is consistent with what David believes already. We've seen him express this in Psalm, at the last verse of Psalm 2. "Oh, the blessings of all who take refuge in Him." We saw it in Psalm 5, verse 11. "All who take refuge in you will be happy. They will sing out forever. You will shelter them. You will bless them and encircle them with favor like a big shield." Psalm 7, we see David has taken refuge in the Lord as judge to legally judge his enemies and deliver him. Looking at this verse in the original languages, it's easier to see that there are a lot of plurals in this. The words "say," "flee," and "your" are all plural. So it's multiple people telling David to flee. And if David is to flee, it's going to be with multiple people. And it appears that the mountain to which they would flee belongs to more than one person. What mountain is this? It's hard to say for sure. The southern part of Israel was very hilly, mountainous, and the Jerusalem was built on a hill, Mount Zion, they called it. It's hard to imagine any other mountain than that one, Mount Zion, that David would consider fleeing to if he was besieged, but I'm not aware of any times that David was actually besieged or threatened with being besieged, but maybe he was. This is some kind of a army intelligence that's come to him saying, you're about to get sieged, and David is thinking, how do I respond to this one? Or maybe this is earlier in David's life when he is still running away from Saul. Saul's chasing him throughout the Judean desert, and David is hiding in mountain cliffs in order to keep himself from getting killed by Saul's army. The implication of that first phrase, however, it's in the Lord I've taken refuge, is that it's not the mountain where David sees he's going to get refuge. It's the Lord that he's looking to provide refuge from this threat. In the 300s, St. Augustine paraphrased David's response by saying, I trust in the Lord. I keep to that mountain. How can you say I should pass over to your mountains? Verse 2 continues with these counselors speaking to David, giving him two reasons why he should flee. Because, verse 2, look, the wicked men will bend a bow. They set upon string their arrow to shoot through gloom towards those who are upright of heart. And then in verse 3, we get the second, because the foundations will be demolished. So there's two reasons. Because you're going to get shot at, and the foundations are going to get destroyed, and there's not going to, you're going to lose. That's why you need to flee, David. And it's interesting that there's a parallel statement in verse 7 where David says, no, there's no reason to flee in fear because God is righteous. But I'll get to that in a minute. Who is talking? It doesn't appear to be the enemy. The threatening enemy is not the one talking. It's this group of people giving David advice. We need to be careful where we get advice from, because there's always going to be people that are happy to give us bad advice. David's grandson Rehoboam fell prey to that, didn't he? When he followed the advice of the young progressives in his cabinet instead of the advice of the older, more conservative counselors, and Rehoboam lost most of his kingdom as a result. Be careful who you listen to for advice. Watch out for people that will play up your fears and play down faith in God. Watch out for people who will not encourage you to launch out with trust upon God. You're not the victim. In Christ, you are the overcomer, right? Romans 8, you're more than conquerors through Him who loved us. There's, of course, wisdom. There's a balance of wisdom in that. But counselors that focus on what God can't do and on what a victim you are probably not the ones that are going to help you grow. There's an interesting word here. The Hebrew word is awful. It's translated gloom or dark or shadows. King James translates it privately, secretly. But everywhere else this word occurs in the Bible, the King James translates it darkness or obscurity. And Job 30, it's the opposite of light. Psalm 91, it's the opposite of noonday. What it conjures up for me is the image from Tolkien's Two Towers, the Battle of Helm's Deep, where all the good guys are in this mountain stronghold with a big wall, and then this vast army of black orcs comes in and fills the valley in front of the castle. They've got their bows, and they're converging on the hapless citizens of Helm's Deep. Verse 3 says, "As for the righteous man, what can he accomplish? Because the foundations will be demolished." Back in that same Battle of Helm's Deep, remember that if you've read it or seen the movie, the orcs come in with explosive devices and they blow up the wall so that they can, they undermine the foundation so that they can get in to the courtyards of the castle. And it looks like it's all over for the people in Helm's Deep. It's scary when things like that happens and it looks like everything is lost. I think that the modern versions are correct in continuing the quote marks of the faithless counselors on to the end of verse 3. A Hebrew word for destroyed, haras, is used to describe soldiers tearing down a wall, tearing down the wall of a city. It's also used figuratively in Proverbs 14:1, where the foolish woman tears down her own house with her own hands. The fear, the threat is the order that David stands for, the civil order that David stands for, is under threat. It's about to be demolished. The word for foundations, the Hebrew word is satot. Cross-referencing with other things doesn't really help much because it only occurs one other place in the Bible, and translations are all over the place, whether it's pillars or purposes or weavers. It's kind of hard to see what the commonality is between pillars and purposes and weavers. But when you think of it, what is it? What is the fabric which undergirds the order that we care about in our lives or in our government or in our society? I think that's what it's talking about. David and his the government of David and his leaders was going to be undermined. We see that happening with the different rebellions that came like when Absalom rebelled against David, and the whole government was undermined by this usurpation. On the other hand, the early church father Augustine referred it to the foundational doctrines of Christianity. There are things that we care about that undergird the church and provide the order and the theological structure for everything we believe. And Augustine, of course, was embroiled with defending the true faith against heretics like the Donatists and others in North Africa in his day. Today, what worries me, the foundation that probably makes me most feel panicked, what can the righteous do about, is the marriage foundations, the fabric of marriage, which is being destroyed in our country. The attacks have been bold in the last century to do away with the distinctions between men and women. And just the last decades to do away with any sense of right and wrong as to how people relate to each other sexually. There's now a clear move to do away with any recognition of marriage. Just there should be no such thing as marriage recognized by the state. It's just people can associate however they want. Is what the press is for now. Of course, it'll start with homosexual unions, but that's going to make marriage meaningless, and marriage is going to go away entirely if it continues in that direction. Of course, also the threat, a concurrent threat, is once the fabric of marriage is destroyed, then the responsibility for child raising is also destroyed. There is no more parental responsibility for raising children. It all belongs to the state. We're seeing that. There are many wicked people today who have cut loose from submission to God and His laws and are intentionally trying to do to undermine the foundations of marriage and of other things as well in God's order. And they made a lot of progress. And it makes me panic sometimes, thinking, what can the righteous do? It's all coming unraveled. Remember the context of what it means to be righteous in David's theology, though. It's not about, righteousness is not about perfectly obeying a set of rules in David's theology, although it does involve recognizing that God is the lawgiver and judge and that we are accountable to His laws. In David's theology and in the apostles' theology of the Bible, righteousness is a gift from God, whereby He makes us righteous through providing a way for sin to be atoned for, and that's done. That provision is done through the death of a perfect substitute. From our point of view in history, we know that perfect substitute was named Jesus Christ. It was His death that paid for sin and allowed God to take our sin away and reckon us righteous. Receiving salvation through Jesus' death and submitting ourselves to Jesus' leadership then is the only human basis for righteousness. The hope of the world is not in goody-goodies trying to fix the world by civilizing everybody or developing all the other countries or making them democratic. That's not the hope of the world. The hope of the world is in receiving God's gift of righteousness purchased by the death of Jesus. So I see this question, what can the righteous do, to actually be a trick question. The righteous can't do anything. Do you see the righteous doing anything in this psalm? I mean, okay, they're trusting God. That's doing something. But it's not an activity. He's not saving himself. He's not doing anything to save himself. The answer to this, what can the righteous do, is not we need to get out and do something. It's we need to focus our eyes on God and let Him do something to save us. As we follow the rest of the psalm, we also see the righteous beholding God's face, but God is the one doing the action of fixing everything. I don't want to go overboard with that. Certainly, beholding God's face is not easy, and it doesn't mean doing nothing. But we're gonna be tempted. We're going to be tricked into believing that it's up to you and your power to fix everything when you see that things are wrong. And what David is demonstrating for us here in this psalm is, no, it's not up to you to fix everything. It's up to you to trust God and let Him fix everything. What are you going to do? Begin by setting your eyes on God. Verse 4, Yahweh is in the temple of His holiness. As for Yahweh, His throne is in the heavens. His eyes see. His gazes will test Adam's descendants. Most translations have the word eyelids there. Hebrew word seems to be related to the word for flutter, afaf, and there's parallelism with the eyes. But if you look at the rest of the Old Testament, there are other passages which associate this word with the breaking of dawn. And then there's a Proverb 4:25, where it says to set this afaf straight before you. And I'm not sure how you set eyelids straight. The Hebrew word there in Proverbs 4:25 in that case is usually translated gaze. Set your gaze straight before you. And I think the word gaze fits well here in Psalm 11:4. The gaze is something that can flit around, or it can be kept straight in front of you. And then when the sun rises, it can be like a big eye gazing upon the earth. I don't know. I see that all being related. That's kind of the way Hebrew works. The basic idea of this verse, though, is that God is both the transcendent King of the world in heaven with power over all the earth, but he's also the imminent judge who seeks out to know everything that's going on the earth. He evaluates the integrity of every human being, and he decides what's the most fair thing to do in every case. That's the basic idea. He's high in heaven, but he's also intimately engaged with what's going on the earth. 2 Chronicles 16 tells us, "The eyes of the Lord move to and fro throughout the earth, that he may strongly support those whose hearts are completely his." And Proverbs 15:3 says, "The eyes of the Lord are in every place, keeping watch over the evil and the good." 1 Chronicles 29:17, "O my God, I know that you test the heart, and you delight in uprightness." This is what God does. And when we see God, and when we can zoom out and see the picture like this, that it's not this one threat that's threatening us, but there is a God who is all-powerful, sovereignly in control of what's going on, and watching what's going on, and judging what's going on, it's not so scary anymore. The thing that's threatening us doesn't have to be so scary anymore, because God knows the threats. God is powerful enough to preserve us through the threat, so we don't have to panic. We have good reason to trust God and not be afraid. Verse 5 continues, "It's Yahweh who will test a righteous man, but as for the wicked man and the one who loves violence, his soul has hated." God hates. We saw that in Psalm 5. "The praiseworthy will not position themselves before your eyes. You have hated all workers of iniquity. You'll destroy speakers of falsehood. The man of bloodshed and deceit, Yahweh will abhor." It's part of God being a personal God. Persons like some things and don't like some things. There's no such thing as a personal being who doesn't have likes and dislikes. And God hates those who are rasha, wicked, or detached from him. As the literal meaning of that word, wicked, rasha, is detached. They're not paying attention to his laws. They're not under submission to him. They're not going to acknowledge his authority. And also God hates those who love violence. Now this is not to say that all forms of force are bad. We see in Matthew 11:12, "From the days of John the Baptizer until now, the kingdom of heavens is forcing itself, and forceful men are seizing it." Jesus commends force in certain contexts. Those who get into God's kingdom will not be characterized by laziness, but rather by vigorousness. But in Psalm 11, what God is saying he hates is people who love the violence for its own sake, who enjoy hurting and destroying God's creatures. And I think that hatred extends even to those who love the virtual experience of violence. When you know, experiencing that in movies or video games or role plays or books, we need to be very, very careful about about the love of our heart, and not giving that to the forms of violence which are very prevalent in our culture and the forms of entertainment. What is it that your heart loves? Is it in tune with what God loves? Jesus said the greatest commandment was to love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, and love your neighbor as yourself. As we look at this psalm, we can see that David's counselors, who seemed to lack faith in God, could only see the threat that the enemy was presenting in the physical world at the time. But now in verse 5, the view zooms out again to discover what's going on in the bigger picture. It's not the wicked who are testing the righteous man. It's God who is testing or trying or examining the righteous man. And God is doing this test by presenting David with an opportunity to either panic and forget God, trust in his own strength, or the opportunity to grow in faith by trusting God in the face of a threat and experiencing God's deliverance from that threat. Does that bother you that God would put tests in front of people like that? Opportunities to either panic and trust in their own strength, or in faith trust in God and wait on his salvation? God does that. We see he did it to Job, and the same word test is used in Job 7:18. Job was a good guy, but God allowed him to be afflicted with disease and the loss of his children and the loss of his possessions, the loss of his reputation, business losses. Job said, "When God has tested me, I will come out like gold." Same word, test or try here. Job matured in his faith through that hard experience, and he learned about how much greater God was than he was. God tested the Israelites when they were wandering through the desert from Egypt into the promised land. And they ran out of water at one point at Meribah. Psalm 81:7 says, "You, the Israelites, called in trouble, and I, God, rescued you. I answered you. I proved you," or tested you, "tried you at the waters of Meribah." Here was an opportunity when the Israelites had no water and were afraid of dying of thirst in the wilderness, as an opportunity to either panic or trust God for his provision. And God did provide. That was when Moses hit the rock and water came out, enough water to feed millions of people. Amazing. God provided. It strengthened their faith somewhat. The same word here is used for trying metal in a furnace, a purifying furnace. Proverbs 17:3 says, "The refining pot is for silver, and the furnace is for gold, but the Lord tests hearts." When metal is refined, you have to get it really, really hot. You take the ore that has some metal in it and some rock in it and other minerals, put it in a crucible over a furnace and get it really, really, really hot until the metal melts. And the impurities, the rock parts and the other elements, actually just burn up and evaporate until all you've got left in that crucible is gold or silver, whatever that precious metal is that you're trying to get. But that means letting things get hot enough to burn up the impurities. That's not fun. When the furnace cools down, it's fun to see the precious metal that's more pure and more precious, but it's not fun when the crucible's heated up and things are getting burned out of your life. But that's what God does to us. He turns up the heat at certain points in order to free us from sins that would otherwise hamper our happiness and hamper God's happiness in us. There's a number of others. The whole Babylonian captivity, God says, was a trial of the people, which refined them. Psalm 66:10 says, "For you have tried us, O God. You have refined us as silver is refined. You brought us into the net. You laid an oppressive burden upon our loins and made men ride over our heads. We went through fire and through water. Yet You brought us out into a place of abundance. I shall come into your house now with offerings. That is God's intended result from the threats which put that kind of pressure on us that allow sins and impurities to be burned out of us so that we come forth as gold, purified, and more eager to worship Him. So when you experience a threat, whatever it is, you know, health or somebody else threat, you know, some other person threatening you or something related to your job or whatever it is, whatever the threat is, the tornadoes coming through, whatever the threat is that makes you come unglued, consider this. It may be a test from God to give you the opportunity to trust Him more and bring greater blessings to you. Verse 6 says that God will rain down upon the wicked net snares and fire and brimstone, and the allotment of their cup will be a raging wind. The cup, which unfortunately the NIV omits, is literally a container that you're going to drink from. Your personal container. It seems to be in the Old Testament times. It's like your cup was something you owned. It wasn't something that you washed and anybody else might drink out of after you washed the cup. It's your container for what you're going to drink, and so it's used figuratively in Scripture as a metaphor for the experiences that you're going to have in life. The cup that you're going to drink are the experiences that you're going to have in life, kind of as a metaphor. In God's economy, certain people get certain things based on who they are. And David tells us the allotment for the wicked is these four things. Pachim, which I think means a net for trapping birds, such as it would be used in trapping birds, or something that's made flat. A number of translations transpose the last two letters and make it pachmi, which would then turn it into coals of. But I don't think it's called for to go switching letters around and from the Hebrew text. Although, of course, coals would kind of fit better with fire and brimstone, but there is a good biblical basis for snares all around or, hailing down upon the wicked. We see in Job 22, verse 10, there's this picture of the wicked with snares all around him, with these same kind of net snares all around him, and sudden dread terrifying him. Proverbs 22, 5, thorns and snares are in the way of the perverse. They're all over his path. Jeremiah 48, 43, and this is also actually a quote from Isaiah. Terror, pit, and snares, net snares, are coming upon you, O inhabitant of Moab. God is raining down terror and these snares. And I also noticed that all the English versions that render the Hebrew word coals in Psalm 11, 6, in the three passages I just mentioned, Job 22, Proverbs 22, and Jeremiah 48, they all render it snares, same word. Things that will trap them, trip them up, render them unable to keep moving like they want to move. God is going to send those kind of circumstances upon the wicked. We also see He's going to rain fire and brimstone on the wicked. Brimstone's just burning sulfur. We recall that should recall God's destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. Fire and brimstone literally fell out of the sky onto those towns because there were not even five righteous people living in those five towns. God has punished wickedness in the past. In addition, he did it among the Israelites too. This raging, scorching, burning, or tempestuous wind. We see that showing up in Lamentations 5:10, describing God's wrath against the Jews after they had become idolatrous. In Jeremiah 13:24 and following, God says, "I will scatter those who are accustomed to doing evil like drifting straw to the desert wind. That is your lot, the portion measured to you from me, God." And that's exactly what God did in that Babylonian exile. Instead of a substantial inheritance, the wicked get wind. You can't store wind. You can't use wind. That's all they get for their inheritance. These allusions to God's acts of judgment that are past and future to David, Sodom and Gomorrah, Babylonian exile, remind us that God has punished sin in the past, and therefore he will continue to punish sin in the future. We see that in Ezekiel 30 and Revelation 20. We see a future coalition of armies in Ezekiel 38 and Revelation 20. Coalition of armies that marches against God's people. They seem to be invincible in their might. And God's people's faith is tested. What are we going to do? The whole world is marching against us. We're going to get crushed like bugs. And then God promises to destroy all those enemies in yet another display of his amazing saving power to execute judgment on the wicked, save the righteous. God will punish those who live in rebellion to him and who seek to harm those of us who love God. Why? Verse 7, because Jehovah is righteous. He has loved righteous things, and his face will see the one who is right. David's fairly crowing here. You say, I should run away from the bad guys because they've destroyed the foundations and they're aiming arrows at me. But I say, God is watching these threatening developments. He isn't going to let the wicked prevail because God is righteous. I think the King James and the ancient Latin, Greek, and Syriac translations are correct here by making God the subject of all the verbs in this verse rather than making the upright the subject of the last verb. My main reason for saying that is that the third verb, see or behold, is plural in Hebrew. And the only plural noun that could be its subject is the word face, which in Hebrew is plural, but in English it comes out singular. So I think his face has to be what sees, and then therefore the righteous or the upright has to be then the object, what he sees. And that results in a logical syllogism if you read it that way. God is righteous, therefore he loves things that are righteous. Therefore, in my particular case, I'm upright, and so God is going to keep his eye on me. I see that as the syllogism flowing like that. Nevertheless, the translation of the ESV and NAS and NIV does not actually contradict what Scripture says in other places. Job 19, I know that my Redeemer lives, and in my flesh I shall see God. It's true either way you read it. God and those that God has made right through Jesus' atoning sacrifice will behold each other, and it's going to be a mutual experience. And by the way, this Hebrew word, yachazu, it's not the regular verb for see. It's the word that's used for visions and oracles. So it implies not just seeing, but also a depth of knowledge and understanding what's going on behind the outer appearance. That is a profound description of the depth of relationship that we will experience with God in his presence in heaven, with the amazing God who loves us. So what can the righteous do? What do we do to get that kind of love and relationship with God, for God to love us that much, for us to be upright so that He'll love us? What do we have to do? The New Testament writers tell us that righteousness comes by faith in Jesus. That's how we get that righteousness. Romans 4:3-5. Abraham believed God, and it was credited to him as righteousness. That is the process. I'm not saying he earned it, but that's the process. That's what he did. He believed what God said. Believed God, salvation would be sufficient for him. And that was all he did for righteousness. Next time then you see a threat to your well-being coming up on the horizon, I encourage you, place your trust in God who loves you. Place your trust in God to deliver you. And He will credit that as righteousness. And He will love it when you do that. He will love you and He will deliver you. And you will see that what you feared isn't such a big threat after all. That God will deal with it justly. I believe that is the lesson of Psalm 11. May God give us grace to actually live that out in our lives, and the faith to trust Him in all the things that threaten us.